It's always so shocking when somebody will come up to me and say, like, oh, I know about your band. Like, my friend told me about you. And I'm like, wow, like, people actually know us. Yeah.
Yeah. It's... Yeah, no, I was gonna say something, but it's one of those things where I go to say something, and then whatever I was gonna say is just out the window.
It's so. Okay.
Yeah.
It'll come back. Yeah.
Hey, this is CGSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. You just heard most of an interview with the Muppet Boys, who are playing tonight at the Hollywood Theater in Vancouver. And all that was left was just them telling you to go see that show. So go check it out tonight. And in the meantime, listen to this other song that they talked to, Brexit Girl, talked about. Welcome back to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. That was Brexit Girl by Muppet Boys. You heard an interview with Muppet Boys before that, and you can hear more of Muppet Boys at the Hollywood Theater this evening, Thursday, November 27th. Go check it out. Go do that. And now we're going to hear a piece from our community journalist, Danny Nesvedarani.
See, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. On November 13th, BC Human Rights Commissioner Kasari Govender released a statement regarding the provincial government's ongoing response to BC's toxic drug crisis. In the statement, Govender calls on the BC government to emphasize evidence-based policies in order to address the crisis, accusing their current focus on criminalization and involuntary care as being influenced by stigma. To learn more about Govender's statement, as well as what proposed actions she believes the province should be taking in order to address the toxic drug crisis, we sat down for a conversation where she was able to explain her reasons for releasing this statement.
So we released a position statement on the toxic drug crisis. In many ways, it reflects what many experts in the field have been saying for a long time, and it brings that into a human rights perspective, essentially arguing that, you know, in order to respect the human rights of folks directly who are directly impacted, people who use substances, who come from all walks of life, some of whom deal with substance dependence, addiction, but some of whom don't. All folks, to prioritize their rights, we need to take policy steps that are rooted in the evidence rather than in ideology. So that means prioritizing, for example, safe supply, access to safe supply, and harm reduction services rather than emphasizing criminal law responses to the toxic drug crisis.
We then asked Govender to expand on her statement that the BC government's actions towards the toxic drug crisis were being driven by stigma of drug use and drug users.
I worry that the response has been based on, in part at least, on kind of an understanding that, you know, prioritizing, first of all, kind of the perspective that this is about safety on our streets for non-drug users, rather than prioritizing the lives and the human rights of those who do use substances. That's not to say that all of us don't want safe streets, that all of us benefit from communities where we feel like ourselves and our families, our children are safe in our parks and in our public spaces. We absolutely do. And happily for us, getting more safety in our streets and our parks is the same as respecting people's human rights who actually use drugs, which is we need a solution to this problem. You know, a lot of people in the wake of this, with much of the negative comments in the wake of releasing the statement have been, you don't care about the problem. You don't care about the people who are dying. You just think people should be able to kind of use drugs and as much as they want, and you're sort of promoting their suffering. In fact, this is the opposite. This is about saying what actually addresses the toxicity of drugs. These are the substances that are killing people or causing serious brain damage. You know, let's actually get to what the real solutions are. And the evidence shows that the real solutions lie in these kinds of public policy responses that may not intuitively at first feel right. But it's not about what's intuitive. It's actually about what the evidence supports. So I very much want to address the toxic drug supply. I very much want to ensure that people are not dying and seriously injured through toxic drugs. And ultimately, that will make all of us safer, whether we're directly impacted by this crisis from someone we love in our lives or ourselves, or just because we see this around us in our communities.
Later on in our conversation, we asked Kasari Govender to provide examples of different places in Canada as well as the world that have enacted policies similar to what she is advocating for.
I mean, I think every context is different for sure. When we can look to certain countries in Europe, we can look to Portugal and others to see how some of these policies have rolled out. Unfortunately, you know, the evidence from Canada either hasn't been listened to or hasn't been given enough time to play out. So, but we can see the evidence of how we've done so far under a prohibition model. Under a model where access to substances is illegal rather than the focus being on the safety of the substances that people are accessing. And we can see that because this drug toxicity crisis has arisen in the context of a prohibition model. It's arisen in the context of the existing, you know, legal structure, which says that drugs are criminalized and that therefore we wouldn't try to make the drug supply safer. We would just try to eliminate it altogether. Well, that's great in theory, but that actually hasn't worked. That's exactly what gave rise to this situation in the first place.
Lastly, Kasari Govender left us with some more suggestions for what she believes needs to be prioritized when addressing the toxic drug crisis in BC.
So in my view, it's this position, again, despite how it's sometimes being represented, this position is not opposed to all forms of involuntary care. Sometimes involuntary care can be the right step from a human rights perspective if it is the last resort. If the science backs up that people will actually come out better than healthier than they went in, and that they have the right safeguards in place so that they can challenge the fact that they're being detained against their will or the conditions under which they're being detained. Those are all vital elements of having an involuntary care system. But even before we get to that point, we need to ask ourselves where we're spending all of our energy and money and resources in terms of addressing this crisis. Where we need to be spending that is getting access to treatment options that exist now voluntarily. Putting aside for a second, we need access to safe supply, we need harm reduction facilities, we also need access to voluntary mental health services. You know, I think probably everyone listening, I certainly can draw multiple examples from my community, my community of loved ones, family and friends, of folks who tried desperately to get access to services and were unable to do it. And that worsened their mental health, it worsened their reliance on substances because there just weren't the resources available at that front end. Let's invest properly in services where people can actually choose to access services. That is a human rights respecting model, respects people's agency. But in addition to that, we also respect the science. I'm not a scientist, I'm a lawyer. That's partly why we put together this statement, so that we could look at the evidence out there and ensure that, you know, we weren't basing this kind of legal model in something that doesn't have actual basis in life. But what we see is that the evidence backs up the use of voluntary care services, it backs up safe supply, backs up harm reduction. And so we know that, you know, there's some really problematic evidence about what happens when people are put into involuntary care only for substance use disorder. So were they not for other mental health issues, but only for substance use disorder. And then they come out and sometimes are more vulnerable and are more likely to overdose and die as a result. So we need to make sure that we gain we're making policy decisions that are actually based in the evidence.
Once again, that was our conversation with BC Human Rights Commissioner Kasari Govender on a statement she made where she claims that the BC government is currently addressing the toxic drug crisis through policies that stem from stigma rather than evidence. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
Get ready for Listen Up. The Geography Student Union presents a night of live music starting at 5 p.m. on November 29th at the Student Union Building Ballroom on SFU Burnaby Campus, featuring Sleepy Gonzalez, The Lunchtime Band, and Tiger Really. Tickets are $15, available online or at the door while they last. Open to all ages and everyone.
Reporting from Vancouver, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. Nardwuar, the human serviette, has been a fixture of the Vancouver arts and music scene for over three decades. Getting a start at UBC's campus community radio station, CITR, in 1987, he's since become one of the most well-known names in music journalism, interviewing artists and bands from Nirvana all the way to Pharrell and Sabrina Carpenter. On November 13th, the Hollywood Theater hosted Nardwuar's Video Vault, a public event where Nardwuar gave a talk on his career, achievements, as well as his love for CITR, and community radio.
And the purpose of CITR is to expose people to thoughts and ideas that they haven't heard before. There's nothing wrong with the common information that's out there, but why would Kirchner take that back? Try to provide something extra. At CITR, you're not a DJ. A DJ is told what to do. At CITR, you're a writer, you're an operator, you're a producer. You're in total control of what's going on. Especially now with independent media, the power is in to create. It's absolutely amazing.
Throughout the event, Nardwar passionately spoke on his prolific career as a music journalist, including some insights on his interview process.
Yeah, that's how hard it was to get your interviews out there. Now, the power is in your pocket, but I had to record interviews on CITR on cassette, then dub it to Real Trill, and then press to vinyl, and then mail the vinyl records to be pressed, and then get the records back, and then mail out the records to various community campus radio stations to get my interviews out there. It was so hard. Now it's like completely easy to be able to get your stuff out there. And I also noticed my mom mentioned the library. She went to the library. She went to a library to research. It's like pretty obvious to actually do something, but that is how hard it is to get your music out there a long time ago.
He also spoke on some of the failures he's experienced throughout his career as well.
This is a letter we got back from The Late Show. Dear Nardwar, thank you for sending us the videotapes and clippings regarding your show, Nardwar the Human Serviette. We have discussed it at a recent talent meeting and unfortunately do not feel it is right for our show. Thanks for thinking of The Late Show and taking the time to write. And this is the part that hurt the most. Enclosed, please find the tape you sent us. Ah! I thought, okay, I'm rejected, but at least I'll keep the tape for like Christmas parties. But they sent me back the actual tape. I was like, oh my God, so depressed. I thought this would like lead to MTV. And look at the date, March the 25th.
After the talk portion of the event, a surprise concert with Nardwar's longtime band, The Evaporators, commenced. Once the event ended, we were able to speak briefly with Nardwar, where we received this as a gift.
Hi, it's Nardwar, the Human Serviette, saying you're listening to CJSF Burnaby and do-do-loo-do CJSF. Yeah.
This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
Waiting, anticipating, all the precious building, kinda got the feeling like I've got a new lease. On the life I'm leading, where I just abandon everything I'm feeling, and as it gets darker, I don't have to see it, I can close the curtains, choose not to believe it, everybody's laughing, we're having such a good time, everybody's dancing, we don't read the headlines, 'cause the world is slowly burning, I can't help this earthly yearning. Slowly burning, I can't help this earthly yearning. Throw your hands up. good coming. Free Voices at CJSF 90.1 FM, talking to you about
Eagle Nation Universal Production Society. We are 10 board of directors and we are rejoicing for world history. Our show is based on true stories, musical and storytelling and role playing, silent crimes broken. Very interesting series of show.
And a lot of in-depth oral tradition. We play every Thursday from 3 to 4. Come and join us.
Reporting from Vancouver, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. Starting today, November 20th until November 29th, is IndieFest in Vancouver, an annually held performing arts festival that showcases Vancouver's artistic communities, celebrating emerging technologies and immersive practices in the performing arts. According to the IndieFest website, quote, "Now in its sixth year, IndieFest continues to expand artistic practice and nurture equity-deserving voices, bringing people together across mediums, sectors, and lived experiences. This year's theme, Colliding Art Forms, is a celebration of the unexpected ways artists and audience alike connect." On November 18th, CJSF was invited for a sneak peek of IndieFest at the DigiBC Creative Tech Studio, where we were able to speak with some of the artists and staff involved with the festival. This included Debbie Wong, the founding artistic director of Renaissance, the artistic collective behind IndieFest.
I feel like every year IndieFest evolves a little bit, and that's because like we're really trying to serve the local arts community here. So every year we try something a little bit new and we get feedback from the artists. So last year, one of the things our artists were really interested in was exploring new immersive forms and being able to use this amazing DigiBC Creative Tech Studio that we're in, experimenting with the immersive technologies. So we have a lot of works that are in development, like Will-O-Lisht, and that are testing out the screens, the projectors, the lights, the interactiveness that we can incorporate into performances here. So you'll see that in the performances, but also on November 25th, we have a whole evening of creative collisions where artists that are trying out things in the digital space can come and try our screens and our equipment as well. So that's a little bit different this year.
Afterwards, we were given a snippet of Will-O-Lisht, one of the festival's flagship performances, and a production of harmonizing vocals, violins, and loop pedals. The performance included various vocalizations of different nursery rhymes, as well as looped violins and percussion that was being simulated by their hands pressing against the microphone. Once we were finished listening, we were able to speak with Dule Van Den Dam and Haley Sullivan McInerney, the artists behind this immersive production.
I think when there's only two people trying to create a big sound, you're kind of limited with what you can do with all of your hands and feet at any one time. So the loop pedal kind of seemed like an obvious choice. But also, I think there is something in the repetition of it and the reliability of it. And then when you make a mistake, it gets locked in. which is terrifying. But yeah, I guess it was out of necessity initially, and then we've grown to love it and then hate it at different points.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been 3 years of learning. When we first started out, we couldn't hit the buttons for if our lives depended on it. It's yeah. pretty amazing what practice will do.
It turns out.
Lastly, we asked them what they want audiences this year to know about Indie Fest.
I think the design of this show is phenomenal. So yes, there is this music, but also what they're doing behind us and above us and underneath us is crazy. Mm-hmm. And I haven't even seen half of it because I'm trapped in this in this little tent. But mm-hmm. yeah, I think it's a visual feast, mm-hmm. this show.
Yeah, Indie Fest generally programs really exploratory work, both in the kind of things that they're doing and artistically pushing limits and bridging disciplines, but also exploratory in that they really want to foster the exploration of those mediums. So I think the whole festival will be a really interesting range of people sort of coloring outside of the lines.
Indie Fest will be going on from November 20th to 29th of this year, and more information on it can be found at reopera.ca. That's reopera.ca. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain.
This is Bird Note. Ray Youngbear is a writer, musician, and a member of Meskwaki Nation. He considers himself a word collector, writing poetry in both English and Meskwaki, his first language. And he enjoys taking photos of the birds around his home in Iowa. In the spring of 2021, he was spending time with his grandson, Ozzie Youngbear.
We were watching robins around this time, and I just began composing a song based on us watching the robins as they hunted for earthworms. More than anything, to entertain my grandson, to try and coincide the hopping movements of the robin with the song itself. The English translation is Robin, Robin, our grandson enjoys watching you hunt for earthworms, hunt for earthworms.
Ray Youngbear later recorded the song for a music collection called For the Birds, the Birdsong Project. Over 200 musicians, artists, and writers contributed, with proceeds going to the National Audubon Society. Find a link to Ray Youngbear's song and the complete music collection on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.